How does the landscape change now that he's in, biggest challenger to Trump?
The comms people were sitting in a room 3 weeks ago. They're like, here's how we get two announcements.
I guarantee you that's what the campaign stopped. They were cheering. We broke Twitter. Now let's break the campaign website. Make a donation now, right?
It seems to me that they are going to deploy those assets in a slightly more on the ground method than perhaps normally, just in terms of a ratio of dollars to TV versus on the ground. And
you know, those voters there really appreciate when you talk to them one-on-one. For DeSantis to have people on the ground there who can actually talk to those voters is going to give him a leg up over everybody else.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. As the Republican presidential primary ramps up, we're going to dissect the strategy, position, and moves of the campaign teams. And I've invited three incredible strategists with dozens of years of experience working on and leading Republican campaigns to break down the moves campaigns are making and what they'll mean as the race continues. We're going to have a conversation that's a lot like the one strategists have behind the scenes or when we're off mic. So while some of the things we talk about today might leave you and us, frankly, morally outraged, our primary focus here is to understand the strategy behind the moves, who it appeals to, and why a campaign would choose that strategy. As I said, I'm joined by an outstanding panel. Returning to the show is Politicology fan favorite, Frank Sadler. Frank is the chief of staff at Carly Fiorina Enterprises. He also served as the campaign manager for Carly's 2016 presidential campaign and was an advisor to former U.S. Senator George Allen of Virginia. Frank, as always, it's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Also returning, Scott Tranter. Scott is the former director of data science for Marco Rubio's run for president. He's also an investor and advisor to Decision Desk HQ and an adjunct professor at American University, where he teaches quantitative and qualitative research in the School of Communication. Scott, as always, thanks for making the time. Quantitative and qualitative at the same time. It's a double threat. Most people can't do that.
Numbers and words. Apparently they go together. Thanks for having me.
And making her Politicology debut, I'm so excited to introduce Nina Verghese. Nina is a senior director and head of campaigns and advocacy at APCO Worldwide's Washington-based public affairs office. She has more than 20 years of experience in grassroots advocacy and campaign management. Previously, she was the National Coalition's director for the John Huntsman for President campaign, the deputy regional political director at the Republican National Committee, which is where she and I met back in 2008, Nina. And she served in the White House under President George W. Bush. I'm so glad to introduce you to our listeners. Nina Verghese, welcome.
Thanks, Ron. Happy to be here.
All right, let's dive in, gang. Recording on Thursday. Listeners will hear this on Friday. Yesterday was Wednesday, which is when Florida Governor Ron DeSantis officially announced that he was running for president on a Twitter space with Elon Musk and David Sacks. The announcement had some technical difficulties to begin with. They said like over a million people tried to tune in all at once. I was one of them, got booted out several times, almost gave up, and then it relaunched and I got back in. Twitter Spaces crashed a whole bunch of times before they got up and running. They had to switch over to David Sacks' account finally because Elon's had too many followers, apparently. The biggest presumed challenger to Trump's nomination is now in the race. What are you guys thinking? Nina, you want to lead off?
Well, I'll start off with, I think the question everybody's going to ask is why Twitter? And my answer would be, why not? Right? I mean, at the end of the day, I was thinking about it this morning, is how many people actually remember presidential announcements? Honestly, the only ones I can remember is Obama in Springfield. Mm. And then Trump,
football field.
Exactly. Yep. And then Trump coming down the elevator, right? So this is, you know, this is a glitch for DeSantis. Maybe it feeds into the narrative that people are thinking that they're not organized, but you know, he's got plenty of time to rebound and he will. And, you know, on the bright side, as you said, over a million people tuned into this. Do a million people watch presidential candidate announcements? I don't know. To be honest, I'm always working them, so I've never really paid attention. But on the, you know, he's got a lot of time to rebound. And on that, I think he was able to talk about his policy announcements or his policy platforms in a way that you can't do on a stump speech, right? Like he was really able to give details. And I think that was get past the glitch, get past the news media about, you know, about whether it was smart to be on Twitter or not. People who are really paying attention to policy and him are going to go back and read those, you know, what exactly he stands for. So again, maybe just a short bump down, but it'll come back up shortly.
Yeah. Frank, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have much to add to that, right? Like I think the traditional media gets really hung up on these things, but I think most of us know here that an announcement's a day. Yeah. You'd love to have that day perfect. Your candidate would love to have that day perfect. But at the end of the day, it's not catastrophic in any way. It never has been. I think Nina makes a really good point that the nice thing for the governor is he got to get his policy points out in a fairly kind of structured way for him that doesn't happen on a stage, doesn't happen in front of a large crowd. It just doesn't work that way from a speech standpoint. This format allowed him to do what I think he likes to do, which is to dive into policy. And so I think it was a really interesting strategy for them. And the glitch is like glitches happen, right? Like they can happen if you do it in an event hall and you can't get enough people in them. You know, that's happened to some candidates, right? Or you try to go on a live TV show to announce your candidacy and you get bumped because some news event happens, right? So, you know, these things are not perfect. But I think for him, it was a wise way to kind of get his message out.
Yeah. Scott, top line thoughts? Go ahead.
I was going to say, I have no evidence that this is true, but it was like big in the internet 10, 15 years ago. It's like when you have a launch, you want it to go down because that's a story, right? So many people are going to your website, signing up for your tickets or whatever. It went down. And I didn't attempt to watch it, but I read some of the coverage and I know Elon, I know tech people, and I kind of got the feeling that what it was, because when you look on Twitter on what like David Sachs and some of those guys were saying, they're like, oh, we just had so many people, it went down and all that kind of stuff. It seemed like a planned comms event that did not go planned. Again, I have no evidence that's the case, but like that's what this felt like to me, is they wanted to say we had so many people, we broke Twitter.
I guarantee you that's what the campaign stopped. They were cheering. We broke Twitter. Now let's break the campaign website. Make a donation now, right? Yeah, that was a very good moment for them.
Which is another interesting point. The website, for several hours afterwards, and there's a lot of commentary on the website, and you should kind of see our like Slack channel on it and all that. Not a web guy. I'll leave that to everyone else. But I thought it was interesting and probably pretty smart. The website just went directly to the donation page, which is pretty smart.
Yeah. Absolutely. Also, WinRed's like load balancing is probably finely tuned at this point, and they're ready for a heavy influx of traffic in the way that DeSantis' website might not have been. So, okay, I want to talk about how the landscape is changing now that this, you know, the biggest presumed challenger to Trump is officially in the race. But before we do, let's spend some time on the content of the announcement. So, I listened to the whole thing, almost the whole thing. I didn't read any of the coverage about this conversation because I knew what it was going to say. It was going to just, as Frank said, focus completely on the outage, on the, oh, it was so bad. It was broken. It was so ill-organized. He started off with a stump speech instead of talking about, you know, whatever. However, the content spanned immigration, inflation, being harder for working class people to make ends meet. They spent a good time railing against mainstream media, lots about the woke mind virus, the culture war, CBDCs even got a shout out, which we've covered on Politicology quite a lot, more than other places. What did you make of the content, Frank?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I mean, again, this is not a moral conversation, but yeah, I thought it was, I think they set it up really well to let the governor dive into the weeds, which again, in most of these announcements, right, we're going to go talk at 30,000 feet. We're going to say nice things about America and our family and our history. And we'll give a few platitudes to like immigration and tax cuts. And like this allowed the governor to do something that no one else has gotten to do yet, which is really to go into the weeds. And that is a bit of his comparative advantage, right? Is he's got these governor years where, you know, again, right, wrong, or different, he has gotten a lot done. And United States senators don't get that. And former ambassadors to the UN don't get that. And so again, he's playing to his strengths, regardless of the coverage, to the people who, at the end of the day, the stories will get, like, what's helpful with this is now it's all in a place where folks can go and listen to it, right? There's transcript now. And so I think it was a very effective way to do it that you just do not get to do. If you announce on the CBS morning show, that's not what happens, right? You get 4 minutes before the next break. And so you may get one nugget in there. He got to have not everything, but I bet almost everything he wanted. And he got to do it in detail. And he got to do it with, again, like him or not, Saxon and Musk are very smart. And so like those are good conversations to have with good people, obviously favorable questions and feedback. So like, yeah, again, I thought it was really well done.
One of the moments that stood out to me in terms of content was when they brought, so there were guests there too. It wasn't just, it was David Sacks with Elon Musk and Ron DeSantis. And then they brought, just like you do on Twitter Spaces, you know, in true to form, they brought on other guests, other surrogates, other supporters, but people who were having a conversation, a dialogue with DeSantis, and not just like giving a 2-minute introduction stump for the next person to walk on stage, right? It was very engaging. One of the people they brought on was Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who's a Stanford professor who was critical of the lockdowns and based on, you know, a lack of scientific evidence at the time. And he recalled a time when he and DeSantis were trying to have a live YouTube conversation. YouTube shut it down, censored it. And that sparked a conversation about how, about two things. One, censorship in a time when it seems that we've lost a free speech culture. And also a lack of reflection on the part of our institutions that we have trusted to keep us safe and make decisions that are scientifically sound and not ideologically driven. And I thought that really resonated with a lot of people both on the stage and listening. So I wonder what you guys made of that particular thread and sort of, you know, this is a very dicey issue, but it seems to me there are a lot of Republican primary voters especially who are really upset that there hasn't been an accounting for the way public policy decisions, public health decisions were made during the pandemic, and that we've sort of on the left tried to just sweep all that under the rug and say, well, we did the best we could at the time, when really there should have been a more full-throated full-throated ownership of the mistakes that were made and the decisions that were made. What did you think of that particular thread?
I didn't watch it, to be honest, but you know, Frank made a good point that, you know, DeSantis going on Twitter allows us to go back and listen to it again. And tomorrow when I drive to the beach, that's actually what I plan on doing, as opposed to, again, what I probably sit down and watch a campaign announcement. Probably not. But, you know, him having the doctor on plays to probably, in my opinion, his greatest strength, which is why did DeSantis become famous in the Republican Party? It's because of what he did during COVID, right? That's when his star really rose. And so to me, you know, again, I'm going to go listen to that tomorrow, but I think having someone on who's a third party that can really speak to his greatest strength is a great asset to him.
Yeah. Scott?
Well, I was going to say that kind of plays into when you looked at his polling coming out of the pandemic and during the pandemic, you know, a lot of people had a lot of opinions about his personal and Republican beliefs and all that, but he got very high marks on governing and executive. The hurricanes, the pandemic, I understand, you know, the school policy issues are very controversial nationwide, but he's looking at polling on that. It wasn't universally loved in Florida, but he was picking the majority on some of those issues, at least in his own state. And the business angle of it, you know, this Disney tiff it will be interesting to see what the polling says on that. But originally he was thought of as very good about, you know, bringing jobs to, Florida, even more so than his predecessor, Governor Rick Scott, who made his entire gubernatorial career about that. You know, Ron DeSantis had better marks on that than he did, at least in the polling aspect. So I think that's why he hit on it, but you know, that is his record, and that's what that he's leading on. He wants to spend a lot of time talking about that, I'm sure.
What's the significance of Elon Musk and David Sacks in this equation? We were talking about this a little bit offline yesterday, Nina. I wonder if you have thoughts. And which voters do you think it helps DeSantis appeal to? Or is this like a, you know, fundraising move for him to cozy up to people like Elon and Sacks?
I think it could be a mix of both. I mean, you know, if you're DeSantis and you're railing against traditional media, who is a better advocate and a supporter for you than Elon Musk? And so, you know, again, I believe he was having a private dinner with donors anyway after the fact. I'm curious to see how many of those WinRed donations or small dollar donations. But, you know, to me, if you are railing against the media, there is no better, or traditional media, I should say, and there is no better advocate to be on with Elon Musk. Not super familiar with David Sacks, so probably can't answer that portion of the question.
Yeah, I've been listening to the All In podcast for a while. David Sacks is on that. It's a sort of venture capital, Silicon Valley oriented podcast, but they do talk about politics. I've found it super enlightening to hear how Silicon Valley thinks about politics. It's just a completely different perspective. And David Sacks is definitely, you know, the conservative in that group. Frank, did you have any thoughts on that part?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about this is there's some calculation I would bet that Twitter, Elon, Sacks, all in podcasts, this crowd may have a moment over the next 6 to 12 months that can really shape the conservative chatter class, the kind of the way, I don't mean it to the scale of Rush Limbaugh or Fox News, but like it could be this other angle to feed your message. And Sacks is clearly in the heart of that. The all-in podcast is growing. It's, don't get me wrong, it's niche. It's not, you know, the 8 p.m. slot on Fox News. You got to find a way to spread your message. You can't be the only messenger. And so having folks like David Sacks and the Twitter crowd kind of on your side, I think is helpful from a chattering class standpoint. I also, it can't hurt in the fundraising, right? Like these guys are going to have to raise hundreds of millions of dollars. David Sacks is a pretty good guy to raise some money for you. And so, yeah, I think it may be a good 2-for-1 for them.
And there's also enthusiasm there. What we know about podcasts and what we know about Twitter spaces and long form audio formats is that there's a high level of retention and listener engagement as opposed to something that you can sort of watch on TV and dissect into clips. And also one of DeSantis's biggest weaknesses is how robotic he comes across sometimes, right? His demeanor, his ability to act natural, be the guy you want to have a beer with, that a lot of that is visual. And this format was audio. You're not distracted with how maybe awkward he comes across while he still works on getting that fluidity to his sort of body language. I thought that was another sort of format smart decision. And sort of the fundraising on the DeSantis website right now, they've got a ticker running with a list of donors, like you do, first name, city, and amount. And one of the things we know about digital marketing is that super helps conversions. When people come to the website and they see a whole bunch of people just like me, at like every second there's another name up on the website. It's a tried and true marketing tactic, and now they've just got a flood of those going. So okay.
One posed question for everyone here. The Twitter angle, especially David Sacks and Elon Musk, right? So it's audio only. And that is in a completely different crowd because he did get an 8 p.m. interview with Trey Gowdy on Fox. So this seemed like something that, you know, the comms people were sitting in a room 3 weeks ago. They're like, here's how we get two announcements, first announcements, two different demographics. We get the Twitter crowd that, you know, is going to talk about us. And then 2 hours later, we get all the people who can't even spell Twitter.
Yeah.
Now, you know, the Fox News, you know, digital made sure that wasn't the case because they didn't talk about it all, you know, all during their primetime stuff. But like, I think that's why it was Elon Musk and David. Because I said the same thing. It was like, I know who David Sacks is, but like, no one in the Republican primary knows who that guy is unless you're between 18 and 34 and you're into venture capital and you want to move to Miami. Yeah. So like, I didn't quite get it, but I think that's what it was. Minus the, you know, everything went down.
Yeah. And I mean, and also every interview that follows this is going to lead with, oh my God, you broke Twitter. What was that like? Right. And the mainstream media is going to cover that as like a downside, but I think it's a huge asset for him. Okay. So let's move to the broader landscape then. So DeSantis is in. There was some, I think, very smart speculation for a while that he wasn't going to do it, that this was a bad time for him, that it wouldn't have been a good decision to do this right now. And I was persuaded by that for a while. How does the landscape change now that he's in? He's the biggest challenger to Trump.
I was going to say, you know, if you look at this from, I guess, a modeling standpoint, which is probably not the best way to look at it, is we are so early in the game and there are so many combinations to go. It's really hard to understand what this does, because I will just remind everyone at this point in the 2016 election, we all thought it was going to be President Chris Christie. And then, you know, fast forward 3 to 4 months, we all thought it was going to be President Scott Walker, you know, all those different things. And so I think there's quite a bit of game to go. And so, you know, it's interesting to look at the polling now. It might even be a little bit more interesting to look at state-based polling, but I don't know what this does to the field because I don't think most of the people who are going to decide this have even pondered that question, much less taking action on it.
Yeah, I think the polling, I think you're absolutely right. Like, you can go back in history over and over again and look at the polling and watch things change from now until September and September until February, right? Like that's going to happen. I think one of the big things this does is, you know, clearly DeSantis just has a massive operation, right? And it seems to me that they are going to deploy those assets in a slightly more on the ground method than perhaps normally, just in terms of a ratio of dollars to TV versus on the ground. And I think in a place like Iowa and New Hampshire, where we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of voters, right? We're going to talk about tens of thousands of votes or less as the margin. You have these kind of assets, like you could put, I've kind of talked about this for years, like you could put a target on actual voters, right? Instead of a target on like, oh, we're going to go get, you know, this group of voters and or this decile, and right, we're just going to go micro-target this. Like, they don't have to do that in Iowa. Like, they have the resources where they can go identify, you know, 100,000 voters and say, we want 65,000 of those 100,000. And they could deploy assets, and I mean like real human assets on the ground to touch those voters in a way I'm not so sure I saw in 26. I can't speak for 2020, the Democrats, but in 2016, 2015, as much as I wanted that to happen, we never had the resources to do that. But I think DeSantis does. So that does, I think, had he not gotten in the race, which I'll be honest, Ron, I don't agree. He was always getting in this race. They're always getting in the race. Like you should just always bet. They all want to be president.
Fair point.
But now, like those assets and on the ground in Iowa and New Hampshire, I think is substantial.
You want to talk about the importance of a field operation during a Republican primary? I mean, you and I met in the field on a ground game in 2008, trying to rescue Saxby Chambliss in his runoff. How important is it going to be for DeSantis to start doing that now?
I mean, extremely important, right? I mean, that's how you know who your voters are. It's that door-to-door contact to know whether or not somebody is with you. Otherwise, you can run all the TV ads you want. You can go on Twitter Spaces. You can, you know, you can do anything. The only other way to know somebody is with you is they give you a dollar, right? Besides knocking on a door, if they're going to write you a check, that's the only way you know that person is with you. So extremely important that he gets his people on the ground. I think they're going to run it through the super PAC, which is an interesting take, which, you know, I don't disagree with. I think it's very smart. It gives them more opportunities, but to hire more staff to implement that and really give, especially states like Iowa and New Hampshire, where it's all retail politics. And, you know, those voters there really appreciate when you talk to them one-on-one. For DeSantis to have people on the ground there who can actually talk to those voters is going to give him a leg up over everybody else.
Yeah, Frank, that's a model that really became popular in 2015, 2016. We did that on the Carly campaign. You want to explain what Nina's talking about here when we split the ground operation into the super PACs or the hard dollar campaign? What all that means? Can you break that down for listeners?
Yeah, so if you think about, there's two tranches. There's more than two, but just for the sake of this discussion, right, there's a candidate committee that has to raise hard dollars. Those are capped federally. I'll be honest, I forget the primary number this year, 2700, maybe
something like that,
give or take. Yeah. Then there's this, you know, soft dollar, we would call it, but the super PAC lane, where it's, you know, unlimited money. It can also come from corporate donors. So like you really have ability to raise massive sums of money. So the strategy that I'm hearing that the DeSantis folks, I think the Times wrote about this, that the Carly folks attempted in 2015, right, is go think about some of the tactics that a campaign needs to do that doesn't actually necessitate the candidate. Go pull that out of the campaign and hope, right? Because you can't coordinate. Hope that you have somebody running a super PAC that has, you know, good ideas and knows what they're doing, and then let the super PAC go do things. So there's a few disadvantages. The TV, if you run TV out of super PAC, it's a little more expensive than the candidates committee. But on the ground,
discount rate.
Yeah, that's right. But on the ground, if you're hiring staff or if you're putting out like doing events and stuff like that, like the super PAC dollars just go further doing it that way. And you can save your candidate dollars for TV at the end or near the end when the rates really become dramatic on a super PAC standpoint. And so there's a lot of things you could do. You could do research out of a super PAC, you can do polling out of a super PAC, right? And you, as long as you make that stuff public, your candidate and your candidate's campaign can read all about it. And so there's just all these great things you can do out of the super PAC. And it seems to me that's, I don't think DeSantis is alone this cycle in doing it that way, but That is what they're, my understanding is from a ground standpoint, I think they're going to do a significant amount of ground operation out of this pack this cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And even like in the public domain can mean set up a little microsite with a hard to remember domain name and make sure you give that to them ahead of time before you split ways. And then it doesn't necessarily need to be on Twitter, right? It just has to be technically publicly accessible.
That's right. You can also run digital marketing that drives people to give money to the candidate, right? So you could use soft dollars to send money, send hard dollars back to the candidate. So like there's a bunch of ways to do this, but it is an effective way to use limited resources.
Scott, I'm going to come to you on the polling in a minute about what his path to victory is going to need to look like. But before we do that, do you want to spend a little bit of time just talking about what the media mix, like we're talking about TV rates and discount rates for a super PAC, but how important is TV going to be in a Republican primary? I mean, is this like the TikTok election, not for Republican primary voters, but like everything's online now. So how much does that really matter? If you're sitting in the DeSantis campaign, what do you do with the media spend?
I'd actually be curious to hear Frank's answer on this, but I don't think it means a lot. I mean, obviously you're running it on, targeted stations like a Fox News. Maybe in a state like a California, where obviously you're not going to be able to hit every county or town, but in a New Hampshire and Iowa, I can't imagine TV is going to give you much more bang than I have a lot of money and I can spend.
Yeah. Frank, any thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's going to be some opportunities on TV because of the way the calendar falls always in terms of the football schedule. Like there are some opportunities for TV that are still relevant, even in Iowa and New Hampshire. I agree with Nina completely. Like, if you can save those dollars so that you can spend them in Ohio and in Florida and in California, right, where the media markets are vastly bigger and the number of voters are massively bigger. So building a ground operation, for example, in Ohio is a lot different ballgame than doing it in Iowa and New Hampshire. And so TV becomes more valuable in those states and more expensive, right? So you have this double issue. And so, if you can save, not that you want to save dollars if you're not going to make it, but if you're going to be strategic and thinking about this from a calendar standpoint, if you can save some dollars out of Iowa and New Hampshire, South Carolina is bigger, more expensive than Iowa and New Hampshire. So if you've got extra dollars that you can put on TV in South Carolina, that is incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
It also gives you access to niche audiences. I mean, the Hispanic population in this country, right, has been growing and there's that out there that shows that a lot of them are not a lot of them, but there are more and more every single day that lean Republican, and that does give you access to, putting on commercials on Univision and other, Telemundo and other channels that the Hispanic population listens to.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike Madrid's talked a lot about that. The fight over the Latino vote is going to be, decisive, over the next 10 years. And also just on the media point, one of the things we know about Trump is just how masterful he is at manipulating free media, right? Free media. He doesn't, there's a case to be made that you can spend a lot less on paid advertising and just continue to keep your name in the print media, in the traditional media by pulling stunts. And DeSantis seems to want to be able to do that. I don't know if he will be able to do that. I don't know how much he'll be able to continue that, now, but Scott, speaking of the 800-pound orangutan in the race, he has been leading the Republican primary right from the jump. His lead over DeSantis has grown. In 538's average, Trump had a 16-point lead over DeSantis. That was on March 1st. Now that's at 34 points. Trump's gained 8 points. DeSantis has lost about 10. How do you read this now? What's the path going to need to look like for him?
So I'm going to be a pollster stickler. I would say the 538 average that you are citing is actually not relevant to the Republican primary.
Okay.
Because that poll does not elect Republican candidates. It's the Democratic version. It's the state polls, as we all know. It's the state polls that do it. Now, I will say, when you look at the state polls in Iowa, South Carolina, Nevada, even Florida, all the other ones, the trend that you describe at the national level holds. But again, the national poll does not elect anybody. It's the state ones. Yeah. Now, inside those state polls, whether you look at New Hampshire, South Carolina, or Iowa, the trend has fluctuated. There was a point at time where, Ron DeSantis in some polls was tied with Donald Trump in their home state of Florida. And there were times when they were within 5 points of each other in New Hampshire. That is not the case today. Donald Trump is ahead of Ron DeSantis in Florida and ahead of New Hampshire, ahead in Iowa. But the polls are a lot closer there. And I think that, I mean, those are the ones that elect the nominees, not the national stuff. And the national stuff's easy to write about. It's easy to do a headline. It's easy for a reporter to grasp when they got 45 minutes to a deadline. So that's why you're going to read about it. But the state ones are the ones that I am watching. Everyone else should be watching. And those are closer. Although the trend holds, Donald Trump is ahead.
Yeah. So okay. I agree.
Yeah.
That's 100% correct. What I remember in my fog of 2015, that one of the things that's scary is that while the state polling is clearly an indication of how the state is going to vote, the trends at the national level are these indicators to donors that donors can't, like, you can talk to donors until you're blue in the face about the poll in Iowa or South Carolina or Florida. But at the end of the day, unfortunately, they're picking up the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the LA Times, and they're looking at these national numbers. And if Trump, to get specific here, if Trump can continue to keep a national lead, it will help him from keeping donors out of these other races, right? Or out of these other candidates. And so again, yes, you don't win the primary by winning the national poll, but you need momentum. And that national poll, that's what these donors look like and or look at. So if you're David Sacks and you're trying to get your friends to a cocktail party to give Ron money, it's a lot easier if the numbers are collapsing, meaning coming closer together between the two, than if they're getting further apart.
Totally. Totally good point. Okay. There's been and will continue to be a lot of speculation about whether, you know, candidates, all the candidates in the race are angling to be Trump's vice presidential nominee, or, you know, what are they actually shooting for here? All of them are going to say they're aiming for the nomination, but, you know, things have soured between Trump and DeSantis. Is there an outcome besides the nomination that you think is a win for him in particular? And we'll get to some of the other candidates in a minute, but for DeSantis, if he doesn't win the nomination, what is a really valuable consolation for him?
Good approval ratings among the Republican primary electorate.
Okay.
And then, you know, if he doesn't win the nomination, but he comes in second, is he the heir apparent if Republicans lose in 2024?
Yeah, I mean, he's got to, they're both right, right? Nina and Scott are both right. Like, what he can't have, if he's not going to win, is he can't have pissed off, excuse my language, 40% of the electorate going into 2028, right? Like, mm-hmm. Everyone knows that, like, you have to have a foundation to start with. And what DeSantis can't have if he doesn't win, he can't be worse off going into the next election cycle. That is really, really hard to convince your donors to do this again if your numbers look worse than they did when you started this game. And that's the dangerous game. It's the dangerous part about, like, if you're not going to play to win, you got to be really thoughtful about what you're going to do. But on the flip side, if you're not going to play to win, you will not win. No one has ever won the nomination not playing to win. That is not a thing. I'll just speak my opinion is no one has ever gotten the nomination because they were playing for second place or because they were playing for next time.
Okay. Really quickly, is there a world in which you can see DeSantis accepting a VP nomination or Trump even extending one to him after all this? It doesn't seem like that's something that's in Trump's DNA, but let's just say Kellyanne, you know, convinces him to do that. I don't think she would either, but is there a world in which that happens?
I can't imagine what I mean.
I can't see it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have Trump on the ticket. You know, I would think the DeSantis voters would probably hold their nose and vote for Trump, mm-hmm. you know, over. And then the question is who is the VP? What is DeSantis bring to the ticket right. That Trump doesn't.
Right.
And I think there are plenty of other capable uh-huh. candidates who we're going to talk about shortly that can fill that gap.
Yeah. Frank?
Yeah, I mean, politically, it doesn't make any sense. But then on the flip side, like, Trump doesn't make a lot of these decisions because they're politically wise. On the Trump thing, like, I don't see why he puts somebody like that who could potentially, you know, from a policy standpoint, seems smart. Like, there's just a bunch of reasons why they just seem like an odd mix. And, like, does he really trust DeSantis to be quiet for 4 years the way the former vice president was? Like, I don't think he can trust him to do that.
Yeah. Scott?
In a convention fight, Donald Trump says he makes a deal. That's the only way.
Yeah.
They're, you know, they actually make it to a convention and these guys actually have, you know, gridlocked versions of delegates and, you know,
yeah,
that's the way. I could go either way.
Yeah. Totally.
Okay. Let's move on to some of the other candidates. I want to talk about Tim Scott. I want to talk about Nikki Haley. Let's do Haley first. So Wednesday morning, she launched a new ad going after DeSantis as an echo of Trump. And it showed clips of an ad DeSantis used in 2018, teaching his child with a MAGA sign. It showed the clips of Trump and DeSantis side by side, making the same hand motions. It fits with how she's been branding DeSantis as Trump without the charm. What do you make of her strategy, Nina?
Smart.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when I think about DeSantis and Trump, that's exactly how I think about it. You know, and to me, in some ways, DeSantis is Trump light. And so for Nikki Haley to be able to say that both of them are the same, here I am, I'm different, is probably the best strategy she has right now in terms of being able to differentiate herself from the rest of the pack.
You think she has a lane? You think she's looking for one?
I think she's looking for one.
Yeah. How much does being a woman help her or hurt her in this race?
I don't know the answer actually right now. I think it, you know, Trump is getting so much attention. Now DeSantis is getting attention too. I mean, perhaps with some women, they're probably grateful there is a woman candidate out there. But I think as Frank and Scott said, like a woman, if she is polling, you know, fifth or sixth in, you know, in the primary, are they going to go vote for her as opposed to say, I would rather go with number one or number two?
Yeah. Frank, the early strategy here kind of feels like DeSantis is saying Trump has legal problems and I'm the only other person who can be the champion of this movement. And Haley is now saying, if you want an alternative to Trump, you probably need to look further away than him. How do you read that? And then Scott, I'm wondering if you see any numbers that support that or point to who's more likely to make the right bet there.
Yeah, I mean, I think Haley's making a bet that like she doesn't want to alienate the Trump people. And so she's trying to carve out this space that's neither Trump nor DeSantis. I'll be honest, I don't really see that lane. And I mean, Scott and Nina know better than I do. I don't really understand that lane. It doesn't mean there aren't voters for that lane, but that lane's going to get occupied not simply by Haley. I assume Pence is going to go look for part of that. Obviously, Christie's going to go look for part of that. If Sununu gets, he's going to look for a part of that. If Youngkin were to get in, like, that lane looks filled. And then on top of it, I do think it makes sense to try to tie DeSantis to Trump so that maybe you can wedge those people together on one side of it. The problem I see with that early on is it doesn't do a lot for Haley, right? It may do a lot for the non-Trump, non-DeSantis people as a group.
She's not that person yet.
But she doesn't have that lane yet. So it's like, she's kind of doing a favor. It's almost like a buffet eat, like she just set up the catering so that other folks can eat off of it. And I think that, I thought that was kind of an odd way to do it right now. I think strategically it may end up being right. It just seems like she's spending her money to do something that doesn't directly maybe not help her.
Yeah. Scott, if you're advising the Haley campaign, what do the numbers look like and what's the best strategy for her now?
Oh man. I definitely avoid giving advice to specific candidates, but you know, the polling has been pretty consistent. If people are looking for lanes that, you know, and especially when you look at some of the qualitative, some of the focus group stuff, there are a lot of people like, you know, I really like what Donald Trump, you know, fought for, but I don't really like what he says on Twitter and some of the stuff he does and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I think it's the media and the government going after him on all these lawsuits, but man, why does he always get in these? Right. So it's one of those, they've got a lot of excuses for it. They know there's probably something there. You know, they don't take the middle ground. They don't take the, where there's smoke, there's fire. They're like, well, where there's smoke, there's probably a few sparks. And so if you can pull on that thread as a candidate and say, look, I've got, you know, the tax cuts you think you like, the border wall you think you like, all these different things you think you like, but I'm going to be a little more polite and I'm going to be a little bit more statesmanlike. That's probably a thread you can pull on. You know, and you can kind of see that. That's a little bit what Nikki Haley's announcement speech was like.
Yeah.
You know, I imagine there was a version of DeSantis' rollout yesterday that was pushing on that. And I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but not a lot of mainstream media has been covering Mike Pence, but you know, that's exactly what he's saying when he's going to these faith and evangelical conferences down in the South.
Yes.
And so, you know, I think that's where you're going to see it. And, you know, I'm sure Chris Christie and Sununu and Youngkin are looking at polling and saying, okay, well, that's the lane. Now that lane from a polling standpoint is not 40, 50, 60%. But then again, none of these lanes look like 40, 50, 60% when you start.
Yeah. They don't need to yet. It's still super early and there's time. Okay. Last thing on Nikki Haley. She's going to do a town hall with CNN. Everybody knows all the controversy around CNN and the Donald Trump, town hall. I'm not one of the people that thinks that they shouldn't have done it. They received a lot of criticism for that, but, she is going to join them in early June town hall. So it's coming up in a couple of weeks. She'd become the second member of the primary field, obviously, that they'd have on. What is the upside for her? What's the upside for CNN? How can she use this opportunity? What does she need to do to really, you know, this could be an inflection point for her, or it could be a campaign ender, really, if she really messes it up. You know, a couple of weeks ago, Frank, you and I and Mike were talking about the Republican primary, and he said, you know, she needs to come out and hit him in the face, Trump. And you think this is an opportunity for her to do that?
I mean, it could. Like, is it an opportunity for her to do it? Of course. Is she going to do it? Doesn't seem that way. I mean, the truth about this is not Trump on CNN. This is Nikki Haley on CNN. CNN mm-hmm. already has a ratings problem. So like, she's not going on a Super Bowl ad, right? Like, I think we made such a big deal out of the Trump thing for all the right reasons. Again, whether you liked it or not, from a rating standpoint, it mattered. It drove coverage for days. I will be shocked if a CNN town hall with Nikki Haley drives coverage, unless this is a pivot where she goes and attacks the frontrunner.
Right.
I don't see her doing that, but I don't see if she's just going to answer questions about Ukraine and debt ceiling and immigration and her record in South Carolina, which I think is great. I tend to think a lot of her policies may be wonderful. That's not going to drive any news coverage the next day. It may not even drive news coverage on CNN the next day.
Right.
So,
right.
But if she comes out Nina's whacking the front runner, that'll drive news.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. What's the best case scenario for her here?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, Frank is right. Like, she really does have to come out strong, and it can't be, this is my policy on Ukraine, this is my policy on XYZ issue. What people want to see right now and what's going to get the news clips is her going after Trump and also possibly going after DeSantis.
Yeah.
You know, she takes either of those two on and really to what, you know, the ad she did on Wednesday and really say, this is how I'm different, and really go in a hard-hitting way that, you know, I think Republican primaries voters want to see, then maybe there's a lane for her and she'll get some news coverage. But again, if she just answers questions, she's been doing that all this time.
She's
anyway,
got to land a punch.
Yep.
She's got to land a punch, I think.
And then, you know, I think Republican primary voters also want to see, if, you know, love him or hate him, Trump comes out as confident and strong. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think Republican primary voters want to see it, and that this may be an opportunity for her to kind of show herself as a strong candidate.
Yeah, I totally agree. Scott, any thoughts?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. It is one of those early, we're like, you know, so far away from any definitive voting moment, yet it's something people are going to determine, oh man, you know, she doesn't have it or she does. I'm not going to say it's not pivotal, but it shouldn't be pivotal. And it may be not, you know, she'll have other opportunities down the road, but she's got to make some news. Cause right now, at least on paper, right, when you look at some of the polling on her, she is another governor from the South that has good marks. You know, has the Trump bona fides. But when people look at her and Ron DeSantis, they're like, well, okay, well, what did she do during the pandemic? Or what did she do during her hurricane or all those? She just doesn't have, some would argue she didn't have those opportunities that Ron DeSantis had. But, you know, there's a lot of, okay, well, it's not that I don't like her, but we've got another governor from the South who's got all these things. And so it's interesting. Her biggest strong point is that she did international issues, you know, in the Trump administration, and the war in Ukraine is certainly going to be a topic over this, and potentially China. You know, if she wants to lean on something she has a lot of experience on, and say Ron DeSantis hasn't had some good answers on, at least to the Republican primary the last couple months, have the conversation around there. But I'm sure, as these two will tell you, it's really hard to make like a splash in a town hall about international relations in a Republican primary. But you know, that's kind of her strong suit.
Unless you're announcing a war. it's Okay. I want to get to probably, well, maybe second to DeSantis, one of the most interesting announcements to me, which is Tim Scott's announcement. But we're going to do that basically in overtime in Politicology Plus today. So you can catch the rest of this discussion over in the Politicology Plus episode. And today we're going to release that on the public feed so that everybody can hear it. If you want to get lots more extra content, strategy discussions, extra episodes, subscribe to Politicology Plus by heading over to politicology.com/plus or just click the link in your show notes today. If you're in the Apple Podcasts app, you can also subscribe directly there by going to the Politicology show page and tapping the button there that says get a free trial. Now, Apple does take 30% of all the subscriptions that come in directly through their app. So it helps us out a lot if you sign up directly with us. And again, that is at politicology.com/plus. See you on the other side.